I'm doing pretty well. I haven't slept well in the past week or so, and
it's a long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's not been horrible, but I feel a little bit not as centered as I could be.
That's real.
But I'm okay with that too, because I know the rhythms come and go. And so it's sort of how I feel at the moment. But so I guess if it's okay, and I'm not going to be putting this part on the podcast, but would it be okay if I, or let me ask you this, how do you feel about opening this thing up with maybe just kind of a love intention?
Yeah, definitely.
And do you want me to do it? Would you like to do it?
If you could be, that would be great.
Okay. So just center yourself for a second, and infinite creator, we thank you for the joy of being here, being present. We ask that whatever happens in this conversation of love and light, that it may be given to the world for the highest and greatest good possible, according to your own nature of unity and union. And we thank you for the opportunity to be here as you in this body, in this time, so that we can direct our intention towards the highest and greatest form of love and light. Amen. I'm going to turn this. Well, so by the way, again, not going to record, not going to have this part, but how do you want me to refer you as? Is it Rudy? Do you have a particular kind of pronunciation?
Oh, yeah. Rudy Shade. Like, kind of like Anne Marie. Yeah.
Rudy Shade. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to say your last name, or do you just want to go by?
That's actually my first name.
Rudy Shade is the whole thing?
Tribe Called Quest, you gotta say the whole thing.
Dude, that's cool. Okay. Oh, well, then what do you know? Well, Rudy Shade, you know, you have been, from my perspective, you have been an incredibly welcome presence in our Building Forth community. And I'm so grateful that you reached out to me a little while ago, I guess maybe about a year ago or something. I think you might have seen me on maybe Rick Archer's Boot at the Gas Pump. Do you remember? Was that?
Yeah, it was a bad gap.
Yeah, okay. And I have been enriched by your presence in Building Forth. You bring, from my perspective, you bring a specific skill set that might be unique in our community, and that is a sufficient level of woo-wooism. You know, that's a clinical word. No, you're as woo-woo as they get. You fit right in. You are BIPOC person, non-binary person, someone who grew up with a conventional faith background. I think your mom especially is still very much a part of that. Christian, almost fundamentalist, I think you might have said. And yet you have outgrown that. And you also speak with a kind of depth and wisdom that certainly seems way beyond your age, although I don't know your age, but I mean, it's pretty advanced. And you have that unique blend of love and wisdom and a knowledge of like sociology and really, really well thought out concepts. And I think the last thing I would say that has been very touching to me is how much you engage our community, but I'm assuming the world, with heart, with just this almost brutally vulnerability, you know, that you engage with the world with a fearlessness, certainly courage. So thank you for being a part of our community and for this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be invited, part of this like lots of theological space that I just hold in such fucking high regard, the platform that you have, and being in the community that you lead has been a real blessing to my life in many ways, and has enriched me and anyone that needs to deal with me on a regular basis. if it's okay, I found to, as I was thinking through anything that I might want to say or talk about or anything, I want to just kind of open with just some quotes that really stood out to me when I was thinking about how to respond meaningfully to whatever you brought up. The first is what I like to call my Bible approximation. Like, I went to Sunday school, like everybody, grew up in a religious family, but man, a lot of the exact places and verses and chapters don't stick in my head. I wrote it down twice, but I didn't write it down in my notes. But anyone who knows the Bible will know what I'm talking about. There's a Paul verse that goes, "It's not for me to call anyone unclean or to call anyone common. I came when I was sent for, and tell me why you want me here." That has really stuck out as kind of the undertone of all the things that we've been, you know, talking about that we're going to get into. And there's a Toni Morrison quote from her novel Song of Solomon, and it goes, "Listen, baby, people do funny things, especially us. The cards are stacked against us, and just trying to stay in the game, stay alive and stay in the game, makes us do funny, funny things. Things we can't help, things that make us hurt one another, and we don't know why." And as I was thinking about, you know, the concept of how people are finding room for grace and discourse in an increasingly crazy world, those two things were coming up. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, our conversation today might be even more comprehensive than just some of the thoughts that you had in regards to my dialogue with Victor a while ago, mm-hmm. insofar as my journey, his journey through kind of a conspiracy place in terms of disclosure. And I had specifically asked you to listen to the interview and give me some feedback, which you did. You gave me a nice chunk of feedback, and it was intriguing enough that I wanted to have this conversation with you now and put it on the podcast. And so I guess if we could start with that, and then if we flow into other areas, that would be great too. Is that okay? Okay. You had held what was being said by Victor and I with a spaciousness where you could affirm what we were saying, particularly, I guess, what I was saying, because I'll speak for myself, but also able to see and ask questions from a non-white, male, straight Texan perspective. And of course, that's important because, you know, I am all those things, and there's so much that I miss just by that. And also, I would say that been my experience with people who are interested in these kinds of things, UFOs, disclosure, Law of One, even, the vast majority are white people. And amongst those, I would say the majority are males. And so you have white males kind of really talking to white people, a lot, mostly white males, not always, of course. And they're really, you know, there's a lot of voices and a lot of wondering, like, what is going on with UFOs and disclosure and sort of high phenomena, high strangeness? What's going on with, you know, somebody from your own background? And I know you have a lot going on, but there was a couple of issues that you brought up that I thought were interesting, and I wanted to maybe explore those. One was, I had spoken about this idea of bellicosity, and that's something that I've developed in other places, both in audio and in my writing, a hearkening to the Law of One and the source of the Law of One. The Ra group talks about bellicosity as being the energetics of kind of a warfare stance, an a priori stance, a hermeneutic of suspicion, to where one is looking through the lens of warfare. And then that is the lens through which, you know, one interprets reality. And so however we enter into something of high strangeness, particularly, we're going to enter into it from our own perspective. And if we have a perspective informed primarily through bellicosity, especially if we're not aware of it, then that's the lens through which we're going to engage with it and call it correct. And my own reading of Ra, my work with clients for 22 years, both people of color as well as white people, and theologians that I respect seem to say that there is this need to look inside and deal with the inner life, especially where there's places of blockage, insofar as that we don't process catalysts that trigger us efficiently, you know? And so I'm operating from that lens, but then you bring up a point where, well, what about people who have been systemically marginalized for, you know, hundreds of years, if not thousands? Don't they deserve to have a hermeneutic of suspicion? I mean, isn't that part of their survival? So I'm going to stop and ask you to weigh in and did I set you up okay? Or how do you feel about what I'm saying?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really fair assessment and recap. And to set the framing of where I'm coming from, I wanted to respond to the really thoughtful conversation that you and Victor were having from your experience. And everything you're saying makes sense and made sense. Where I see major opportunities, especially for the heart of the intentionality that I know you wanted.
The main reason that I brought this story up was that kind of frames a lot of what I think about what you wrote about and what you said. I don't know, I forget how Ra organizes it. What is it, like part 96, session 96, working 96? I can't remember, number 96, where everybody goes into the whole, like, there's a cost to love thing. That was one of the first haunt but not explicate things in the Ra material that really stuck with me. And I was remembering that you had that at the end of your talk with Victor. Victor's a very interesting cat. I've only like heard from or exchanged words with maybe like 4 Trump supporters that I know of. A lot of people voted for him on the low. So, but like that I know of out loud, like 4. So it was interesting and good to hear from his perspective of what he's been walking through. And I noticed that you've had several people, like you've given several people the mic who have walked through very interesting stories and backgrounds and like, you know, like old school, like giving people an opportunity to give their testimony. So that's cool. But this idea of love having a cost, I that's something that keeps standing out and I want to come back to that. The main thing that I think, like the number one thing that I think overall, I listened to the I don't know if you want to call it an interview or conversation, like a couple times, and I read your slides and stuff. The first thing I think is that it's really cool that you are so open and reflective about what your journey has been. I see you doing that Barack Obama shit. I don't know if you're doing it on purpose or not, but you know how like the Barack rule, at least that's what like people around me call it, the Barack rule. When you know that you are choosing to have a public life and a public presence, like write your book to say everything about yourself first, so that one, so that other people can't say it, but two, so that people know like the complexity of the texture of your story. So he, in his 2 books before he ran for president, he just kind of put it all out there. And that's kind of what I felt from seeing the way that you put your work together. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing is I'm forever and always, just about permanently, looking at things from, first and foremost, the perspective of intersectionality. Like, that's just where I live, where I stay, what's going on. And there's this term that I learned. I didn't know about this. I don't know how it's pronounced. It's either kyriarchy or kyriarchy, K-Y-R-I-A-C-H-Y. And like, it was invented by a, I believe, queer feminist to describe all of the dominating systems that create issues. So people are often using like patriarchy when they really are referring to a lot more than just patriarchy. Patriarchy is like often a symptom of these things, but it's not like the core fucking causes belly. And I think I'm just going to go with kyriarchy as the pronunciation. I think the kyriarchy gives us an opportunity to separate the angst with issues of access and power and a resource, separate it from masculinity by itself. It's kind of a tangent, but it's less of a tangent than it seems. Like, when we're looking at issues of like bellicosity, both as given and as reflected back, I often think that the far left and the far right are in this very interesting, almost tantric dance of like, the right will like make some of the first, do the opening salvo of bellicosity, and the left will be like, ah, yes, I absorb this, echo this, and give it back to you 50 times stronger. And then the right will be like, oh, more. And then the left is like, fantastic, I live for this. Pull it down into the ground and give it back more. And then you just like keep going until everybody like ascends to heaven / hell. And I think that looking at it as kyriarchy, not patriarchy, could be very interesting in like interrupting that dance or bringing that dance into deeper contemplation without scapegoating and also without accountability dodging or bypassing. My core point with it is, when I'm hearing all of this and what you're saying, the thing that's coming to mind for me most of all is something, a thought that I've been like, I don't know what you call it, a thought that I've been having between myself and my notebooks. Like, what is that? Like, thinking, contemplating. I agree with you on almost everything you're saying, and .. I think it's extremely important in conversations where the impetus or the goal or the hope or the undertone is to get people to investigate their anger or investigate the way that they show up, I think access to resources is an extremely overlooked and important part of these conversations. I see a lot of metamodernist conversation going to this place of what will help support a more balanced and wholeness making conversation. And I agree. But I think that approach is really incomplete without at least an acknowledgement, if not plans to ameliorate the very wide gaps in the bandwidth that people have to do something about showing up in a, you know, fighting or defensive nature, because we can't do anything about the way that an undernourished and overactive root red ray response is going to happen until we do something about it. And that's where I think that there's a lot of room for this conversation to grow in sophistication, like no matter who's having it. Like, Othering and Belonging Institute does really great work on this. ProPublica and Demos attempt to find a more balanced perspective. I hear a lot of that in what you're saying, and I very much agree with all of it, but it's like, people aren't doing this because, like for shiggles, right? Like, no matter which ideology it's coming from or what reason why, this is a response to very active pain that I don't hear as much as I hear about the impacts of the response to the pain. And it's tricky because that's what we're here to talk about, right? Like in these conversations, the point is to talk about ways to have more wholeness, to have more harmony in a system, But I think if we don't name that there is something very wrong that people may not understand how to fix, and speaking about the gap and getting curious about the gap in fixing it, we run a few core risks. We run the risk of creating like shame. If somebody recognizes themselves in those words but doesn't hear a path out, they may be quiet for shame because they get to a place where someone finally sees what's going on and they feel a bit of resonance, but then they feel maybe possibly unworthy of being part of that community or unworthy of being part of that dialogue because they don't know how to, you know, calm the response down that's creating this bellicosity. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is I think that there's opportunities that might be missed for common ground, because even if somebody is being like a wild ass about the things that they are very activated about, both sides, far left, far right, and middle, can typically tend to agree around resource and provision making to help people with their most base needs. And most people wouldn't refuse if their most base needs were offered to be attended to, I think. Thanks for being present for my like early draft of this, because I feel something much bigger beneath this, but I'm working on it slowly. Like, I don't really fucking know, but I'm pulling this theory together, and that's kind of the main thing that I think about what you said. I'm super interested in the off-planet archaeology that you mentioned. That shit sounds cool. What's that about? That's cool. You were talking about it in one of your slides. That sounded cool as shit. And then also, I'm wondering a lot about what do we do about the parts of these very large complaints that are true. I cannot speak at all, and I can't speak for shit, to the more conservative side. I have never been that. I am not that demographic. I don't understand anything about it, so I won't comment on it. And most of the far right response, the conservative to ultra right response, is enacted by and upon white straight men. I have nothing that I can add or offer about that experience, so I won't insult anybody by doing that. So I'm just going to speak from like center left where I was raised to far left where I went in my life. And so much of that bellicosity comes from the fact that like what do we do about the fact that we started this journey in the United States with like smallpox blankets and trails of jewels that led to transatlantic bondage. Like, that's how they got people on the ships, some of them. Like, what do we do about like, you know, crack being on purpose and like the suppression of AIDS science and Jewish people in the ghettos who were told that they'd be able to reclaim their valuables in just a few weeks and to just go ahead and get on the train. And like the what do we do about Tuskegee, right? Like, I'm a direct descendant of Tuskegee. My dad went there for school and he was born in Bama in 48. So like the Tuskegee experiment and all of that, like this hermeneutic of suspicion from the place of those which power systems were enacted upon is not rhetorical. That's one of the major things that kept coming up for me in listening to the discourse and reading what you're saying. For many people, the hermeneutic of suspicion is rhetorical, right? Like, I'm not making any judgment or comment what white dudes with like middle income or like maybe poor and like had to really hard scrabble for their opportunities. Like, I'm not saying nothing ever happens to them, but what I am going to say is for the majority of their lifetime and the lifetime of their direct forefathers, unless somebody's Jewish, like the majority of the lifetime of white presenting male people has been built with society working for them, not against them, structurally bottom up, top down. And like America was not making its money off of their debt. This is not true for ADOS people, like American descendant of slaves people. This place was built on killing us. This place was built on killing indigenous people. This place was literally powered by ignoring the voices of women. And like the binding of the queer experience has been a shared bonfire where when people can't get along, they kind of focus on how much they don't like queers. So like the s'mores of the campfire has been queer suppression. So it's like, it's come by quite honestly, the termination of suspicion. There often is a back there, and it often is malicious. It's not like people are hunting for it and looking for it. It's if you're not looking for it, you're statistically more likely to become dead. And like, as I'm listening, I hear where what you're saying definitely applies to like calm down, take a breath, deconstruct. Like, yes, when white people, mostly white men, are fighting and fearing other white people, mostly white men. Yes, because it's toe to toe. And also, in my opinion, both sides, when we're talking about white on white crime here, sorry, bad joke, but I still think it's fine. Like, when we're talking about that, both sides know damn well what happened to everyone else. And if there's only two major camps left, like liberal leaning white men and conservative leaning white men, everybody knows that there's no rules when it comes to power. And that's why everyone's so fucking afraid, because they see what happens to everybody else. So like, I don't know how to synthesize that like in the theories that you're talking about, but that's what came up for me a lot. Nadia Bolz-Weber often said that something that really stuck with me, that like, you know, this whole constitutional thing about like guns and access to weapons. But if we really look at the root of it, the access to guns was so important for the colonizers because they lived in fear that the tyrants that they were running from would take their guns before they had a chance to defend what they had taken. So like from this balance point of fear and suspicion and violence came a lot of iterations of a lot of things that came after, leading to, you know, our current situations that we're in with around part of the conversation around guns. So there's like 3 to 4 core existential wounds in like the collective Western psyche. And, you know, the global South and Eastern civilizations have their own, which I'm not qualified to speak on, so I won't. But just looking at our shit, right? UK, US, Canada, and like hedging on Europe every now and then, there's 3 or 4 very deep festering wounds that we've not gotten through. And we often want people to get through those wounds on an individual level when we've not given the resources for it collectively. And on the side of those who have been statistically and historically more privileged, a place to put the entire tantrum or fit of, you know, there's this therapy guy who's on Instagram. I can't remember his last name, but his first name is Matthias, and he's pretty cool. And he says a lot of good shit. And he's like, there are many people who will not feel listened to unless they're agreed with. And then there are a lot of people who will not feel engaged unless they are in control. And I think that when we're looking at demographics of people who have been historically quietly installed in positions of control, whether they were consciously complicit in this or they just think that that's how life is, to change or shift that requires a fuckload of bandwidth to deal with the existential scream of like, well, what do I do now? This wasn't my fault. What happened? I don't want to live without the upper hand and control, like in terms of my systemic advantages. That's a whole bunch of bandwidth that's going to have to be created, and somebody's going to need to deal with that screaming. From the position of those who have been historically stripped of their dignity, rights, and freedoms, there is a very long and very valid list of very deep screams that are going to take a lot of bandwidth to attend to. And so I don't really know, like, how, and I don't need to know, but I'm glad that what you said and you inviting me to talk about this gave me the opportunity to like really step back and be like, okay, there's the privileged version of this convo, and then there's the BIPOC version of this convo, and they are very different conversations with very different needs. And neither is exempt from, you know, the balancing that is requested of us from Law of One, if that's the tradition that we're choosing to look at this in. And both are real. Like, both are real human responses to things. So, yeah, the part where you were quoting the spiritual attention span of most of your people is that of a child. I laugh for like an uninterrupted 2 minutes. There's a rap song. It's like one of my favorite lines. Short attention span, short tempers, and short skirts. Isn't that fucking great? Like, it's one of my favorite rap lyrics. And that's what I was thinking about when I was looking at the other part is like, in that same quote and section, it was like something like, it's a building block that like has lost its place and it rolls around and yet we're still going to get paged. And so we're going to be given the same basic information until we do something different. And then we decide that we're tired of hearing the same shit over and over and over. And then we quit, but we're going to hear the same things over and over and over until we get the message and gain in maturity for being able to listen to what we're called to. And I think that this bears on what I was, you know, the kind of point that I had here is like, so we keep saying this message of like, you know, deal with each other like justly and like lovingly and with patience and everything. And we're going to keep like needing to repeat it to advance anywhere as a society, no matter how great our technology gets or supposed access to capital supposedly equalizes, we're going to keep doing the same shit. But I think that there's one more piece that I'd be interested to know if there's anything like in the raw material that references this. There's one more piece of like, when everyone is depleted, where does the initial resource come from to give people the energy and bandwidth to even have these discussions? Like, I have this question of almost every spiritual system I hear about, almost every form of self-improvement that I hear about. It's like, and I look at this from a very Black perspective. If I am running on negative nothing, where am I supposed to get this bandwidth to do this thing that you're asking me to do? And I think that it becomes like the responsibility of institutions suggesting or espousing this theoretical point of view to provide relief. I liked the thing that you said about how warfare mindset like directly precludes a contemplative life. I think that that's true. And I think that the things that put us into warfare mindset should be like itemized and investigated, I think. And it's, I'm pausing because I want to approach this the right way. The other part that I saw on your slides, it was like, I want to make sure I get the right quote. Here we go. We call for aid, we receive answers, yet we stagnate, and in our restlessness and frustration, we are vulnerable to turning our spiritual focus down into the consciousness frequency of the warfare worldview from which warfare disclosure narratives arise. And yes, yes. But here's my counter question. What if when we call for aid, we need like aid though? like people, it's, so somebody goes to the doctor and they think that they're having a certain type of pain. The doctor's not going to necessarily like listen to them for exactly what they think the pain is. The doctor's going to go to the cabinet of what they know and what their training is. So if someone walks in thinking that they have, you know, a heart attack versus herpes versus whatever, like, yes, that gets taken into account, but the doctor's not going to like cater everything to what the patient thinks they have. When people call for aid, they're often asking for things that aren't the source of the real fucking problem. Like, people will be like, oh, I need help with this, or oh, I need these people to stop doing this to me, or oh, I need this to go this way. And like, the calls for aid are often calls to alleviate what we feel are symptoms of the problem. But there's like root cures that can be given. And I think that it starts from like a physical and material basis. One of the things that you say a lot that I think is very interesting, and I know this is like one of your core like things, is people trying to do spiritual development by like reaching like upward, and that they might be better served by reaching downward. My theory is like, yes, all of that, but before that, they're trying to reach like physically out for like food, water, shelter, and like self-esteem. Like, because only from that point can you understand like what your real hunger levels are, what your real panic or need levels are, to know how deeply and how frantically to reach up or down. And like, it's a resource intensive question that doesn't really have any like good answers. But I think like that the low self-awareness that you're talking about is like a coping mechanism, like one of the mighty F's, you know, what is it? Fight, flight, freeze, fawn, the F's. And I think that it's a response to like the vastness of the task and the skinniness of the consistent resources, especially when doing this type of balancing work and doing this type of reconciliation-based behavior is going to put you under more stress because you're moving outside of the societal norms and outside of what you were referring to in your podcast, like the systems of belonging that you either grew up in or found after you were desperate. Like when you were talking about that in regards to how people do things around like church or Trump or all of that, I don't know nothing about that. But what I do understand is the way that people respond to gangs and the sense of belonging that comes from being in a gang. And the sense of belonging that can come when like a jailhouse minister like comes and like has you start doing like Jehovah's Witness pie selling shit like out of jail because they were the only ones who cared. Like that I can understand, and I think that it's similar. So to go against the place, to go against that and to risk the bellicosity of those who gave you water when you had no water is inviting another level of existential stress. And so like that's rough. And I don't know how to account for that. And then okay, flip it to the other side, right? Like if one is living with resources and has been part of the dominant majority their entire life, they've never had practice eating turnips off the floor, like which could actually make this like harder because they've never had their backs against the wall to need to conceive of what it's like to break out of what Campbell refers to as like ethnic Adonkin and folk Adonkin, like the quaint little village that you're in before you start the hero's journey. And I think that oftentimes for people of privilege, the idea of like going to like extraordinary lengths is something that's very optional, right? Like they can choose to go on like some, I don't know, extreme hiking adventures or choose to build some super ambitious company to make fortitude, like deep fortitude and resilience in the face of potential pushback be something that's part of being ethical in itself, not like a bonus for the extra adventurous, that's going to scare the fuck out of people. Like, what happens then, you know? So, yeah, but one of the major questions that I often have for like truthers and like, you know, the whole QAnon thing, again, my number of discourses with this community has admittedly been very shallow. But when I hear somebody that's shared with me that they're even entertaining this, my question is, I'm like, where's that energy about COINTELPRO? I find it difficult to understand where that same energy was in the 80s to the 2000s. Like when people are talking about these oppressors and like overlord like energy, I am wondering how much of it is because like they perceive that their quality of life is compromised, which can be through, you know, the economic downturn or, you know, different things like that, which for sure, like inflation is a bitch for everybody, regardless of where you come from. But then there's things that are kind of like more like self-selected, self-opted into, such as like, you know, masks or vaccines or like things to choose to be pissed about. And it's interesting the parallels between that and then like people, BIPOC activists, like retro people in like the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, talking about like the man and the system and this and that, and the pushback that oftentimes these same truthers will be calling like snowflake or whining. It's very interesting to watch that same energy be reflected. And like I often pause and then look at it just for ways to try and find solidarity with, you know, the obvious like pain that they're feeling, but it's difficult and interesting. And that's how I kind of got to these things about bandwidth, because at the end of it, it's all just one, you know, big, you know, scream. But yeah, I think the other thing that you were saying about spiritual but not religious people, like not trusting an external authority to help them in like sense making and reality, I think that's a tragedy, and I think that's sad. And yeah, I think anything that can be done to prevent that should be done, because if we're doing anything to help, I think one of the best things that can be done is to help people have a healthier relationship with their intuitive sense. Like, to respect it, to honor it, but also respect it through boundaries as much as they respect it through listening. And I think that a lot of spiritual development communities fall short of doing that. And yeah, I think that's a genuinely, like, Shakespeare style, like, legit tragic. And then the other thing we were saying about, it's not the specificity of the information which attracts negative influences. It's the importance placed upon it. And I agree, but this comes back to that, the theme that I've been on. It's perceived as life or death important information among more privileged audiences. It, like, actually is often actual life and actual death for vulnerable audience. So, like, what then, you know? Like, I think that there's a big difference in that, and finding a synthesis for that within the raw material has been something that I've really sat with and, you know, dealt with. And I think that in those examples that you were talking about like the spiritual speaker people, about the way that they were talking about some of their points and how they were trying to use their headlines to draw people in. What I thought was really interesting, I was like, oh, this is just like pain point based copywriting. Like, there's entire schools of thought, like multiple millions of dollars per year go into, and you may know this, go into having people talk that way to about anything, about like the newest massage chair, or like why to join certification programs, or like beauty products, or coaching, whatever the fuck's, like, people kind of just like talk about this. And I've always had this weird feeling about the slippery slope between like commerce and like weird alleys of where we can take our consciousness. And it was just interesting to see all of those examples that you lined up in a row, because I was like, shit, I see this in copywriting all the time. Yeah, I just really don't know what to do about this idea that for some people, fear baiting and fear mongering is voluntary, and for other people, it's historically, like, epigenetically, verifiably real fear. And I think the point that I'm getting to in this is, like, that I think the core distinction to be made is to maybe acknowledge that. I don't know how, without giving preference to one side or another. I leave that to, you know, minds that might be might be thinking at a different angle than me. But yeah, it's like, you know the story about the watermelon monster? There's this tribe of people that believe that there's a watermelon monster. Somebody tries to tell them that there's not a watermelon monster and show them by eating a watermelon. They think that he's like a demon cannibal and kill him. And then somebody takes a really long time to like work with the people painstakingly over a very long time to get them to walk into a field 1 month, touch the watermelon another month, and then realize, oh, it's not a monster. So, like, how can people have enough sustenance to sustain themselves and resources to build those relationships long enough to overcome the watermelon monster gap and not get killed? That's the big bottom line that I'm seeing in all of this. It's like, how are the people who are going to be these bridge makers fortified? And how are the people who choose to listen to them fortified? And where does all of that infrastructure and resource come from? I know that it's like an overly tactical, not overly, it's a very tactical, what do they call it, green ray question. But I honestly don't see how we can address these root things. Even if you get to disposition or like wanting to or whatever, if your cortisol levels are fucked up, you can't do this. If you're like, your blood sugar levels are fucked up, you can't do this. If your like actual neurological way that your brain patterns are functioning and firing are fucked up because of unaddressed CPTSD, you literally cannot do this. So we're asking people to do something that their physical level of sickness in their body may not be able to let them do. And then they'll feel bad, and then it still won't be. So And that's at the root of a lot of like lack of trust in these communities. And then, you know, a good smattering of intersectional history that would that would help everybody, but there's just speaking from the BIPOC, you know, queer, all of my acronym lens, a lack of trust in the newer paradigms often comes from a lack of acknowledgement of how we got here, like a lack of thorough acknowledgement. And if just from my perspective, listening and then speaking to, you know, people that I talk to a lot of my friends. I'm in a very fortunate position to talk to a lot of my friends about like peace and how they're finding peace. And one of the major things that prevents them from having it is that they're like, as soon as I let my guard down, this system is going to eat me. And I can't fucking tell them that they're wrong though. And then it becomes like, okay, well, how do you have like dignity in the face of non-dignified situations? And that's a whole other conversation. That's about like lemons out of lemonade and some, not Marcus Aurelius, but what's his name? Oh, come on. Epictetus. That's some Epictetus shit, which is like, that's about stoicism. That's not about this. That's not about wholeness making. That's about fucking hurting as few people as possible as you get through a rigged game. And so I don't know. Like who enters the doors of heaven fresh from a fight that they had to have, you know? And then on the other side, who enters the door of heaven fresh from fighting that was voluntary? That's a different conversation, but there's something about this as this religious and institutional pain get healed. It's like if the methods of control and power are distrusted, it's worth looking at, you know, why they're used often in the discourse. I think that's a major point that you're making, right? A big point that I hear that you're making is that the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. It's an Audre Lorde quote that you may be familiar with. Like, so it has a lot of meanings, but it was originally made within like the context of capitalism and media, meaning that money and media will not be the tools that will be used to question capitalism media in a deep way. But it also applies in terms of like methodology. So that MLK thing, like hate can't drive out hate, only love can do that. I think that a major set of points that you make are basically that, right? That you're not going to fight fire with fire. And from there comes room to look for solutions and look for bandwidth. So like, I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that a lot. And I think that like, what do we do about the fact that when you are actually legit being fucked with systemically top down, bottom up, it's very difficult, if not impossible to contain the fires that are created by that. And if you believe that you're getting fucked with, and you know, as people on the more privileged side, if they honestly believe they're getting hurt, then they also have a hell of a problem too. Yeah, I think this is just all really, really valuable. And I especially thought that when you were talking about the part where, what did you say? Like the people with blockages in the lower triad, that they often like reject universal, compassion and understanding because they don't get it. And that they've understood that like everyone has like an agenda and attacking first makes more sense. And that conventional ways of understanding our reality can't be trusted. Yes. I think that's true. I think that that's true a lot. I'm just still stuck on. I guess that it has to be just a matter of like what you've been doing in building force, frankly, like sitting still, taking as much power off of the table and making it not a conversation about resources as much as possible, and sit still for as long as possible and be gentle and loving and like, as these little tiny pieces of solidarity and these little tiny pieces of joy and resource like come together like dust particulate in the air takes a long time to make a dust bunny. Like just little particles of dust in the air, they'll take 3 to 6 months to like form a little dust ball. And then how many dust balls do you need till you can start making thread? And then how much thread do you need before you can start weaving it together? Like it's slow, but I mean, I guess fuck, like when you think about it in terms of like time as compared to what it takes to go from a density from like second to third or third to fourth, it takes forever. But like, is it wrong that I have this desire to just be like, pick it up. Like, not at you, but just at the process, you know, the process in general. Like, yeah, I don't know.
Well, amazing. Thank you. I can see now that when I was speaking with Victor, I was speaking with a bunch of assumptions because he was also a white male. And he and I, we differ still probably politically, which is fine. And I know that we differed in our support of Trump and things like that back in, you know, even in 2016 and then 2020 and so on and so forth. And he had his own journey and so did I. But I guess because I was speaking to him, I didn't really explore my deeper thoughts on the disclosure movement and bellicosity and things that you're bringing up right now, because I am 100% in agreement with you. And it was one of the things that really helped me to see just how privileged the general disclosure movement advocates were, because in their own arguments, they were not talking about any of the stuff that you're talking about. Nevertheless, they were finding ways to fight. And this idea of, you know, there's a cabal and there's only a few in charge and it's evil atop. And we have to have a hermeneutic of suspicion with everything that we've ever seen. And I remember at that particular time in my life too, this was circa 2015, 2016, that I was really encountering, I want to say for the first time, although I guess I'd had seeds planted in the past, but really looking at it deeply for the first time. And that was the whole concept of white privilege, the concept of looking at what I consider reality in my embodiment, just walking from here to there in Texas, is different than somebody else, big time. Even
especially in Texas, yeah.
Oh, dude, yeah. And what I had already shifted in my own mind to a more, I guess you could call it, progressive politics, having lived in Nicaragua for 2 years. And really, it was brown and black people there that opened my eyes. Sitting with them over candlelight in the second poorest country of the Western Hemisphere, where they're serving us, you know, fresh lobster from their nets, and then talking for 4 hours about how the government, the U.S. government contra, U.S. government backed contra, where, you know, had tortured certain family members and killed certain family members. And I didn't have any knowledge of politics back then. I was so, well, the only thing that was important to me was the pro-life movement. I mean, it's embarrassing to say, just super, super conservative Catholic, extraordinarily narrow way to see things. And so, I mean, one thing that happened when I went to Nicaragua was, from the very beginning, I went through a depression because I couldn't fit in. And it was not too far away from suicidal ideation, to be honest. But I had a series of what I would call miracles that let me know that I had to stay in the country for my own future, I suppose. And I did. I certainly didn't want to, but I did. And I think what that did is that particular experience of being broken and really not being able to put back the pieces allowed me to maybe be an empty cup. I went down there perhaps with my cup pretty full. And so this emptied my cup and I needed that. Then I go to Boston College for 2 years, or I get 3 years, really learn more about social policy and things like that. And seeing a person inside their environment and really falling in love, to be honest, with the one of the few things that I love about the Catholic faith is this idea of the robust social justice and social dialogue of what constitutes a society that is grounded in values of seeing human dignity everywhere, you know? And even if it's not in praxis very well, it is neat to read some of the deep thoughts there. But, and also I would say that a lot of the groups that are doing systemic social justice are indeed faith-based oriented, particularly with a liberation theology twist. You'll see a lot of that. And you're not going to find conservative thinking in that realm. So whenever I start to see, when I engaged with the disclosure community beginning in 2014, really, I guess, yeah, 2014, and right on up to 2018 is when I started moving out of that. 2020 was my adios. I would say that I was shocked at hearing white people, quote, discover their sense of, you know, justice and something happening behind the scenes, as if that were the first time in humanity. And so actually, I took it upon myself as a white male to write articles to this community saying, wake the hell up. I wrote an article, which I since took down a while ago. It was my most popular one. It got something like 200,000 or 300,000 hits. And it was translated, not known by, I didn't do it. People took it and just went off with it, but like translated into Spanish and French. And on, I found myself on YouTube in French. I'm like, dude, that's weird. But the title of it was something like, you're going to hear the conspiracy here, but the cabal's last trick or something like that. And it was this idea that the cabal is creating an environment to where those who are fighting for social justice actually imprison themselves all the more. I'm not fighting for social justice, sorry, fighting against the cabal. So I was really having in mind the truther community, you know, the disclosure. Fighting for this is actually going to entrap people even more because it's inside this ethos of attack and retribution and all of that. And so I was really a white male trying to talk to other white people saying, no, 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 no. And I guess from a psychological perspective, it was also me trying to help locate the problem is actually not out there, but rather in here. So in other words, I was trying to act as a white male to maybe affect a little change within the white community, because no one else is really responsible for that except for white people. You know, we're got to be the ones to wake ourselves up. I mean, we're too damn stubborn otherwise. And so that's where I was coming from. And I think a healthy hermeneutic of suspicion is absolutely key. It's important. I mean, how could it not be? I just don't think we have to locate hermeneutic of suspicion at everything, and our fingers go pointing to the fourth density reptilian aliens. and then their governmental, whatever, elite minions. Like, that's where the vast majority of the disclosure community, anytime they saw anything that was wrong, and rightly wrong, I mean, let's say, their feelings of injustice, fine, I can agree. Their facts are so off that they're actually in the service of entrapping themselves all the more. You know what I mean? So if someone is upset at, I mean, I don't know, cars on the road. I'm just looking out here and I see I-35. There's cars on the road. So somebody with a hermeneutic of suspicion who's trapped into warfare spirituality, where it's, you know, the light team and the dark team and the reptilians versus the blah blahs, and they're just looking over here and, well, there's cars on the road, and well, that's got to be because there's the cabal's doing this to entrap us, and it's not just the cabal, it's the Dracos, the reptilian dark lords who are in charge, and we got to fight the system. And no, what we have to do, I think, is to learn about how we, and I'm talking to the white folks here, are people in power. We have to look at ourselves. I think that's what always been my message to myself. And it's what I've been trying to say, probably not too assertively, but I guess, as well as I could. Not that I made one bit of difference, by the way. Not at all. I don't think I learned that you can't change people's minds by logic. You have to get to know them and, you know, relationship, and then help them maybe in some ways. But I'll wrap this up. My reflection on it is by saying, I think, and I've been saying this all along because I really believe it, I don't think we even have to look, quote, up there. I don't think we have to even go thinking about UFOs or, you know, fourth density or fifth density or sixth density or the law of one metaphysics. And I'm saying this as somebody who loves the law of one metaphysics. I love the woo-woo stuff, man. You know, I wake up in the morning, open up a can of Esoterica. all that stuff doesn't teach me anything deeper than what I already know, having just engaged the world as it is. And I think that there are powers that be, I would argue, if not directly controlled by white men, it is the effects of colonization. And I think that the powers that be, and I would argue that this is true for all of probably history of the world, the powers that be have in their best interest to stay in power. And so, of course, they're going to work in the background in any way they can, any way we can. I include myself in this, to keep people like me in power and people like you from ever achieving the capacity to change the status quo. I mean, that is,
I also think there's a really key thing that to me is a central point of the distress that the truthing community and the disclosure community is coming aware of. One of the major, major components of systemic oppression is to keep the majority from either seeing or understanding that there is a system that is operated, that it's not just about individual choices and you know, individual outcomes. But to keep people from questioning the order of operations in which they live. There's an amazing amount of time, money, and effort, whether we're looking at, you know, the Koch brothers and the construction and funding of what we now understand is the religious right. That wasn't a phenomenon that existed. That was two extremely wealthy men that realized that by harnessing religious fervor, that they could spend about $1 trillion. They projected how much they would spend in the 60s and 70s when they planned this. There's there's wonderful books about it. The book is called Democracy in Chains. It's great. But they planned the rise of the religious right and how that could be hijacked to create the situation that we currently have with GOP. And for people to realize in one way or another that they're part of a system that they didn't choose, and that what they feel are their values have been constructed or handed to them in any degree or any capacity, that's a very frightening set of things to discover. To discover that they're not in control when a major component of this system working is white people feeling like they are in control, people are going to be very startled, very scared, and very, very frightened and very vulnerable. And if you don't have the undergirding of knowing why this happened or where it came from, hell yeah, you're going to be pointing to reptiles in the sky. What else have you been getting to believe? Honestly. So I have, you know, just the greatest respect and empathy for what you're saying, for what Victor has said, for, you know, for people that have been told a very, very well-constructed, extremely expensive, and very convincing lie. It's kind of just like watching folks kind of wake up. They realize that they're in the Truman Show, and they're very frightened. And I hope there get to be more bandwidth available to bring compassion and understanding to that fear. And I think that a lot of what you do is part of healing that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I want to reflect a little bit on what you're saying there. I say that why I maybe focus in on the individual of going in and working on one's own way to process catalysts efficiently is because we do have to, I do believe we have to start with our experience as we perceive it in this body, in this time, in this way. And I can tell you that as a counselor for the past 22 years, the great equalizer to break down the people's biases, even if they can, well, no, let me say it this way. People can still continue to have incredibly strong, entrenched ideologies, but suffering, especially things like anxiety and depression, will bring people, individuals, to a place of, I need to work on this. And so then they go to a counselor, and that's a great act of courage for them, especially if they've been taught never to do that, because you just got to pray that shit away, you know, or the new age term. And there's so many of them out there. I don't want to name them because, well, people know, but the new age tropes are, you know, we create our own reality, and there's ways to just move past anxiety and depression. You're kind of choosing that if you have it. You know, there's always some grains of truth to, oh, good. Well, that's good. Could you describe a little more what you mean?
Oh, sure. Just the Calvinist idea of, you know, it's been preordained who is worthy or not worthy or chosen or not chosen. I know that not all Calvinists, you know, adhere to this in extremis, but that base theological idea of sheep go to heaven, goats go to hell, can take on some really interesting legs. It is crossed with like bootstrap theory and the basis of capitalism theory. Of, you know, you have what you're worth what you have, and then you just add a tiny sprinkle of some beautiful appropriated Eastern objects, you know, to your setup there, and you have the basis for you are attracting this, you are magnetizing this, you are calling in this, you can override through freedom tech, you know, emotional technique, you know, this, that, and the other, and if you can't, then you're just low vibe.
Yeah.
So that's how we get to the next.
Yeah. Oh, I like that, because that's one of the biggest problems that I see in the New Age community, and it drives me nuts, you know. On the other hand, there is something to be said about, to the degree that I am looking at my perspective, and if I'm only going to see one thing, then that's the one thing I'm going to see. You know, if I'm only going to see how shitty the life is, even if my life is pretty shitty, but that will be the only thing I see. And so without throwing away this concept of like the environment and the cultural issues that we have, certainly the systemic oppression, when it comes down to one person and their experience, all they have is themselves and their experience in terms of like paying attention to that. Now, it could be we can encounter the self. I think there's two ways to encounter the self. In this way, one is paying attention to why am I feeling a particular kind of trigger? That doesn't mean you throw it away. That doesn't mean you get rid of the anger, especially if there's oppression. But then asking the self, what do you want to do with that? You know, do you want to put that towards something that, you know, what are the goals of someone? That's what I always ask, you know, whether they're brown, black, or white, is when we identify the pain that they're feeling and you know, kind of articulate that, the other question that I then ask is, well, what do we want to do with that? If you could wave your magic wand and you couldn't change the whole world here. I mean, that we're working on that, but your own personal way to go through life from here to there today, what would you like And sometimes that is the first time they've ever allowed themselves to imagine what they would like to feel. Not necessarily, you know, well, I'd like to have $1 million, you know. Okay. I'd like to feel rich. Okay. But how would you like to feeling rich? You know, I mean, well, I'd like to feel joy or happiness. All right. Well, what does that look like? And so then you kind of break it down a little bit. And I think the important thing, this is the really hard stuff, perhaps, and I'd love to see what your thoughts are on it, is how do we get to a place, no matter what demographic we might come from, how can we get to a place where we learn how to hold the tension of, and the perspective, I think Ra would call this Blu-ray energy, but this idea of there is a macro world where all of us are one body, you know, human beings are cells inside this larger corpus. And these cells, there's big problems here, and there are injustices. The way I define justice or injustice, at least at this point, is probably not a very good one, but good definition. But the way I kind of think of it is justice is sort of the whatever it takes to get wholeness actualized. You know, whatever's happening, that wholeness out there, unity and wholeness is actualized, where people's dignity are held together, you know, a mutual dignity. And injustice is where you have inherent asymmetry or inherent modes of separation for the sake of manipulation. You know, it's injustice. So how can we, on one hand, work for wholeness making in our outer world, while at the same time realize that we ourselves are working towards wholeness making on the inner life? And there's places inside me that are separated for various reasons, and I can kind of work on that. And that I'm also, I can identify with the outer suffering, but it's also somehow not exactly who I am either. You know, so like, for example, I can identify as a white male, straight white male in Texas, you know, married. I can identify that. But if I just stay right there and don't go any deeper into, well, I don't know if deeper is the right word, but if I'm not more comprehensive in seeing other variables that I also am, and what do I want to do about all these things? Can I hold them all in tension? So I guess what I'm trying to say, and I'll sum up, is how do we hold intention the work that needs to be done in the outer world to make it more of a holistic, wholeness-making, justice place? Learn about all of the injustices and work towards that. How can we hold that righteous anger, the hermeneutic of suspicion, which rightly belongs there, huh? How can we do that while at the same time work towards some degree of harmony and balance, so that our lived experience of being here, embodied here, is one of meaning making and intense meaning making, purpose, dare I say, joy? How do we do that, do you think?
I think that that's one of the most important questions that we can be asking ourselves at this time, particularly within any community that's setting itself forward to look to the future with love. I think that looking at the future with love, baseline default requires an intersectional approach to how people in the community can process love, feel love, and experience that love comes. And that's tricky.
Could you maybe speak a little bit of your experience of what that means to kind of put flesh on it, please? And also one other thing I want to ask you too is, I think you said in your message to me something, would you say instead of hierarchy, it was tyrarchy?
Tyrarchy, yeah. So tyrarchy is a term that's relatively new to me, and I'm really excited about it because all of the things that have come into the lexicon, very rightfully, that we point at, right? will say, this is white supremacy, this is patriarchy, this is ableist, this is sexist. And yes, all of those things are true. But sometimes there's a risk of over-identifying blame when people are enacting one piece of a wider system. Patriarchy is basically any form of activity that is going to court hierarchical oppression, no matter what axis it lands on, whether that's, you know, fat phobia or racism or misogyny or anything. And it can just help us give a little bit of space with the instinct to go, okay, that man right there is practicing oppressive practices, and that person right there is applying something that is misogyny. They are bad and they are wrong and they are. It's not that the behavior doesn't need to get named, identified, and recompensed, be looked at. We can back up just a little bit and say, I am seeing an instance where I am watching patriarchy at play in the system that I'm in. I'm part of it as witness. The person who is enacting violence is part of it. The person that the violence is enacted on is part of it. We're all standing in different positions in this system. What do plural want to do? You know, it's that old adage from marriage counseling, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's not you're wrong or they're wrong. It's we have a problem. What do you do?
Yeah, right? That's beautiful.
But in that we is an expensive fucking word, Doug. Like, we is a very expensive word to hold in a space.
Mm-hmm.
And the unity of the word we. And I think that there's two ways to come at it. The first way is a very start where you are way that I'm going to say I didn't give a lot of credence to until I spent a year in the community that you're in,
mm-hmm.
that you lead the building force community. There's, as you know, I'm kind of quiet. Like I sit, I watch, like I talk every now and then, but I'm mostly there to just listen and absorb the energy, you know, most days. And just the act of knowing that there are people that are sincerely with their whole heart, really for real, trying to understand the world and each other. It took me about maybe 8 months of like seeing multiple Black people keep coming back.
Yeah.
And the effortless, non-posturing, natural outflow of solidarity that would come when queer issues were discussed, when issues of international war were discussed. It wasn't about platforming. It wasn't about anything. Multiple people in the group from multiple ways were saying, hey, this is what's going on. And here's how I feel about it in my heart. How can I hold it better?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, huh. The group is still majority white, but there are more Black and brown and other people and folk concerned with other people that I've seen in any spiritual space that I've been in that wasn't specifically created by and for the BIPOC experience. And maybe about 6 months in, I was like, these white people may not in fact be trying to eat me. That's interesting. So like the transformative act of being in the space, there's nothing that is, you know, specifically brought up, specifically done. It's just the expectation, giving and receiving, contemplation and care, empathy as a practice that we've been going through as a community together. I think that is amazing. And I think that everything kind of starts there.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of where I think it can go, just in terms of, like, you know, the wider context, not specifically before, but just in general,
yeah,
as people are looking at movement. This is a source and a bandwidth-based set of issues.
Yeah.
There are tangible laws on the books that make people's lives bad.
Mm-hmm.
There are tangible income gaps that make people's lives bad. There are tangible opportunity gaps that make people's lives bad. When things are making people's lives bad, they're not really patient for doing shit with other folks, especially mm-hmm. other stuff that's going to be complicated. And that's going to be true whether you have a potentially financially disenfranchised white man who is trying to figure out what to do with all of his rage that from what he needs to understand, to when you have a person that is of a traditionally marginalized identity that may have resources, but is really understanding that they're going uphill, a lot of interference, their experience in their economic, social, civic experience. I think that the real key in my perspective is when you have groups of people that have chosen to come together, 5, 10 people, 15 people that have chosen to gather around toward this future with love, really understanding as much as anyone is willing to talk about what's going on for them. Like, what does your life actually look like? Where are the places where there is pain that has caused you or your family that has nothing to do with your individual choices or your individual behavior? Like, what are you dealing with? What are you joyful for? What are you up against? What's going on? And the biggest question, where do you need help? To ask the question, where do you need help in America is very complicated. I don't know if you saw it, but literally Elmo asked everybody how they were doing. And Elmo got, $2 trillion worth of mental health care needs exposed in America because people replied to Elmo honestly about how they were doing.
Mm.
Like we're talking Elmo Sesame Street, Elmo.
Yeah. Wow.
How are you doing?
Yeah.
And people told Elmo how they were doing and it was bad.
Well, they must have intuited that Elmo wasn't actually playing the normal game of, oh, I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, Elmo cares.
Yeah.
We've been trained and inculcated since very young childhood to rightfully know Elmo cares.
Yeah.
And I believe the Sesame Street workshop took that as their cue to integrate more mental health and societal health things into their programming. PBS has been riding for us from the beginning. Shout out PBS.
Yeah, for real.
But as you just said, getting beyond that normative question and not pushing, because there's a certain amount of trust and intimacy that needs to get built up in a group before those things are disclosed. But when somebody really answers the question, how are you doing? Understanding the systemic factors that are informing that answer of how they're doing, or understanding how some of the gaps that led to their honest response of how they're doing, where do those things come from?
Mm-hmm.
What would it mean to tend to those things? And if you do 3 or 4 iterations of that deep listening, you're going to find yourself in a very tricky position of being tempted to be an ally as somebody works upstream against systemic.
Yeah.
That creates a very interesting life. And that creates a very interesting life because it's not to unpack justice. It's not advocate for people. It's not sit in the recognition of problems being directly caused by lack of money or directly caused by lack of support or directly caused because, something happened and they don't have a parent house to go to and fall back on because that parent could be incarcerated or that parent was systemically denied and redlined out of being able to have a house. Or maybe their family did have a house and then somebody decided to build a freeway over it and evacuated the black or brown neighborhood to build that freeway. It happens all the time. So why do these things happen? Why are they there? And what can be done to support the person in the immediate?
Mm-hmm.
And also, what could we plural be looking at for the wider system that these things are happening in? You start asking questions about wider systems, especially as a white male who may, actually get through the door with some of these questions. You end up in a place where you're speaking to the people that are creating these systems.
And good
luck with that. That's going to be very educational.
Yeah, I can tell you that there's a loneliness there. I mean, but it's something that I'm not any great worker of this. I admire so many people that are so much more, advocate so much better, but I do learn from them. And I would say though, that in my own family, my own experience, my family of origin and so on, for the vast majority of where I came from, I am not understood. And I remember a few years ago, my mom and dad, we met. I was already married, and so my family and them met over at another family member's house for a family gathering, and they were just smiling at each other, and I said, what's going on? They were kind of laughing and looking at me. And I said, well, on the way over here, Doug, we were just asking ourselves, like, God, what went wrong with you? I mean, how is it that you could possibly be a Democrat? You know, we and the only thing, and they were honest, it was a joke, but it was also not a joke. I said, the only thing we can possibly think of is that when you were, I think you were about 2 or 3 years old, you jumped up and you fell on your head in our living room.
Wait a minute.
You know, some kind of effective brain injury.
I wasn't ready for the implication of a TBI. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. All right.
So, but, yeah. But I would say, you know, you're speaking to my heart here and also a teacher to me. I can't see. I can want to see outside of my paradigm, but I can't fully see. And I need my other selves who are not like me to kind of point the way through their own lived experience, you know? And you do that for our group. You do that for me. You do that for our group. And so thank you for just gifting us with your presence and teaching us and for this conversation. I have to go here in about 3 minutes, but I want to ask you one last real quick question, perhaps, and that is, this may not be something you can answer really quickly. It's okay if you just say, let's do it another time. You, as somebody who is not the demographic that I grew up in, Black person, person of color, non-binary, all of this, how do you see people in your demographic maybe thinking about some of the more esoteric stuff that you experience on a daily life? Yeah, things like the Law of One, or maybe not necessarily that particular material, but you know, that esoterica stuff. Like, how do you see it received or understood? Or do you have a sense of that? I'm not even sure if that's a good question.
It's a great question. I was introduced to everything to do with ufology and the thing beyond by a Black man in Baton Rouge. That is the first person that ever got me thinking about this. And he had to work on me for years before I was willing to listen. Very dedicated. Outside of that specific circumstance, people are really focused on pragmatism. The folks that I know who have made it to the other side of the poverty burden are very fixated and focused rightfully on staying there. And the folks who haven't made it out, there's a wonderful Instagram sketch dealing with Black people and UFOs. There's a Black man who says, yeah, UFO walked up to me. I said, I don't give a fuck. I have rent due.
Okay.
That's the nutshell.
Go the fuck away. Unless you've got some money to help me out with this.
Exactly. Like, are you giving me healthcare? So and the folks that aren't living under threat of that are very focused on the very specific jingle blocks that it took to not be in that position.
Yeah.
And they don't have time either. So that kind of, you know, I know we have to end, but that's a great question. I'll be thinking.
Well, let's circle back. Yeah. I mean, maybe we can have another chat in a month or so and keep talking, keep the dialogue open.
And shout out, thanks so much to you and to Troy. Also, if you had told me that some of my beautiful exemplars were going to be a bunch of white dudes in Texas, I said you were smoking crack. And I really appreciate that because it's a testament to what the divine and source and God can do when people show up with the right intentions and treat each other lovingly.
Well, amen. To whatever degree that I am able to be open to you is certainly a grace opinion. Thanks to God. Thank you so much for this great conversation. And I will do some edits and then put it up. And in the meantime, would you mind maybe in the next day or so, if you have time, to go through and find any links on the internet that you think would be a good thing to do to include in the show notes? any, you know, you had mentioned several things, but any kind of resources that you would like that have been meaningful for you or think would be helpful, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, looking forward to continuing our friendship and see you on Tuesday in our Building Forth gathering.
Thanks so much, brother. I appreciate you.
Amen. God bless. Bye.
Bye.